I think back to when we started the podcast and you were like, Whitney, we have to do a podcast. And I'm like, I don't think we can add one more thing onto our list of to-dos and creations. And you convinced me because we were going to be able to talk to some of the most interesting, powerful minds on the planet, and that we get to use this information then to connect into what we do and what we create at Sakara.
Yeah, it's been a really reaffirming experience, hasn't it? And come home to this place of food as medicine. It makes me feel extremely grateful that we get to provide people with medicine. I know we each kind of have our own stories on how food became medicine. And if you haven't heard our stories, it's the first episode of the Sakara podcast. And it's worth a listen because stories are what help us find ourselves, help us remember kind of what we're seeking in life. And my hope is that by sharing some of my deepest, darkest insecurities and the shadow side of myself, that people will see themselves and then be reminded that they too can sit in the driver's seat of their health, even though they might be in their darkest place where I was once. The food that we create here at Sakara is designed to transform your gut and your microbiome health. And when you do that, you change everything about who you are. You change your mental health, you change your physical health, you change your spiritual health, you change your cellular health. When I'm out in the world, people will say, I love Sakara. And I always remind them that you don't have to be on this food program every single day. But if you come once a month for 3 days, or once a year for one of our 30-day resets, or once a year for 5 days in January, if that's all you can do, what it does is it transforms your gut, not just in the moment that you're eating the food, but in weeks and months after. It trains your gut to change the cravings you have, to change your metabolism. It transforms the strains of bacteria in your gut that inform your health for months to come.
That diversity of ingredients that you're getting into your body changes the diversity of bacteria in your gut, which is the epicenter of your health. And it supports your total body health, your immune system, your metabolism, your skin clarity and skin health, and how you age. And so I want to invite you, if you haven't tried Sakara before, you don't need to do this whole big shebang, clear your week and your schedule to do it. Figure out what is holding you back from giving yourself this gift, giving this yourself this step on your path to taking really good care of yourself. You deserve to feel good. You deserve to feel nourished in your body. And we are here to help you do that.
And Whit, we just have to say the one thing we always forget to say.
Oh yeah, it's really, really delicious.
We always talk about how it'll transform your body and your health and your microbiome. But man, our chefs are talented. It's delivered to your door, ready to eat. And it is so delicious. And that, by the way, is part of the nutrition, because you should enjoy the path to creating a body you feel good in. It should not feel like you're depriving yourself. I literally just ate chocolate, banana, granola.
I had a cookies and cream parfait.
I was actually thinking when I was pouring the milk this morning, I was like, I can't believe I used to think I had to deprive myself to have a body I felt good in, to have a body I felt sexy in. That's been the biggest change for me. Mm. So that's our wish for all of you, is to give you the food that helps you feel good and sexy.
You can find more details and how to customize your own plan on Sakara.com and enjoy 20% off your first order of our Sakara Signature Nutrition Program with code POD. That's code P-O-D at checkout for 20% off your first order. Order now. Dr. Garth Davis is a distinguished surgeon, health advocate, and author with over 2 decades of experience in the medical field. Having served as chief of bariatric surgery at Houston Methodist Hospital and as clinical professor at the University of Texas, Dr. Davis has dedicated his career to transforming the lives of his patients through innovative surgical techniques and a holistic approach to health. He is the author of the acclaimed book, Proteinaholic: How Our Obsession with Meat is Killing Us and What We Can Do About It, which challenges the conventional beliefs about nutrition and advocates for a plant-based diet. Through his extensive research and compassionate care, Dr. Davis has become a leading voice in the movement toward healthier living and sustainable healthcare practices. We actually had to reschedule our first podcast with him because he had to take a surgery, and we booked this one in between two other surgeries that he was performing. He's a real doctor on the floor, in the trenches, seeing patients every single day. He's not just a media doctor, and he really does see the effects of diet on our health. So I thought this was a really interesting conversation coming from him and his perspective. Hope you find it interesting as well.
All right, Dr. Davis, welcome to the Saqqara Life podcast. We are very happy to have you.
It's good to be here.
And we've known each other now for, I feel like it's been like a decade now. Long time.
That's scary.
Yeah. I know.
Time flies.
Time she goes.
Where does the time go?
We like to start off every podcast with a question around your personal mission. So what is your mission? What are you here to do? What is your work here to do?
Yeah, it's a good question. My mission has always been centered around trying to prevent the actual thing I'm treating, which is obesity. How can I get it where people don't need to have their intestines cut and their stomach cut to prevent a really lifestyle-related and, you know, physiologic and genetic-related disease?
Can you talk about the complexities of obesity? Because I think a lot of times people think about obesity as too many calories and like the hormonal aspect, you know, the like adrenal aspect, like it's so complex. So could you give us like a brief 101?
It's exceedingly complex. And I get so upset and agitated when I see people talking about obesity and obese individuals not understanding what these people have to go through. And when we study obesity, we study the fact that there's so many different factors affecting them. Let's start with the fact that there's definitely a genetic factor to it. There's been some very interesting studies along that line looking at identical twins. So if you take an identical twins, and they did these very interesting studies in Holland, an identical twin separated at birth, didn't matter what environment they grew up in. If one identical twin was overweight, the other identical twin was overweight. Likewise, if you look at the different twin studies through the years, weight is one of the most inherited traits that we have. That and height are the two most inherited traits. The patients I see have very strong family histories of obesity. Now, you can't say, well, they've got strong family histories because they grew up in that lifestyle, but these other studies on twins does differentiate that. The other thing is you got to understand, you have to walk a mile in these patients' shoes to understand what they're going through. And it's really hard to do that. And so we tend to judge because we are sitting there healthy and we eat what we eat and we say, okay, we're good. Why don't they just do what we do? But it's just not that simple. They did a study, a functional MRI study. So they had patients where they could scan their brains. They took overweight patients and they showed them like a cheeseburger. And their brains and the desire centers just lit up like crazy. Like, oh my God, I want that cheeseburger. But if you take a normal weight person and you show them a cheeseburger, you know, lights up kind of lightly. Like, yeah, okay, I kind of want it. But not like, oh my God, I want it. Which is very different. And you have to understand that response that they get to understand how hard it is. Like we could say, eat less. It's really hard for them to eat less. And a funny example, there's multiple hormones that control these responses. So what's getting them to have that thought process like, oh my God, I need that food? It has to do with many different things. They did another functional MRI study where they looked at the brain and in the arcuate nucleus, like part of the desire center, they had very low dopamine receptors. And so it's harder to get satisfied. In fact, their brains look like a cocaine addict or an alcohol addict. And there's definitely an addiction component to obesity. I guess I could say I've experienced it somewhat I had an injury, and one of the recommendations for the injury was, well, you know, there's these new things with growth hormones. Hey, have you heard of people doing SARMs? Have you ever heard this concept of SARMs? So a lot of bodybuilders use it. Well, there's one SARM that has been shown to help with recovering from injury that is a ghrelin hormone. Now, ghrelin is secreted by the stomach, and ghrelin goes to the brain and says, feed me. You got to understand, we formed hundreds of thousands of years ago in times of feast or famine. And when we were evolving, we evolved a big stomach because when there was food around, we better eat it because otherwise there wasn't going to be food. And we evolved hormones to make us eat. Otherwise, we wouldn't eat and we wouldn't procreate. The problem is we're taking those genetics and we're putting them into this environment. And so I decided I would try taking the ghrelin to see if it would help with my joint. Oh my God, I woke up in the middle of the night so unbelievably hungry. I had to run down and eat two bowls of cereal. And for the next 24 hours, I ate more than I've ever eaten. And it was like an uncontrollable, I can't stop this type feeling. It was an out of the control feeling. And that's what these patients experience. That's why we shouldn't judge, because until you've felt what they felt, you don't understand how hard it is. And then there's other factors. There's socioeconomic factors. I mean, I see patients, they're working two jobs. They've got five kids. They could go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and feed the family for, you know, 10 bucks. And so when I'm telling them, you know, to buy kale and all these fancy foods, and the bill ends up being more than, you know, the KFC and a lot harder to prepare. And there's a lot of depression, anxiety, prior abuse. I can't tell you how many patients I've had that have been sexually abused in the past, and food becomes almost like an antidepressant. So that's a long-winded answer, Danielle, but it is a very complex situation and goes far beyond eat less, move more. Yes, we need to eat less and move more. The question is, how do we get there in light of all these different problems?
And I guess the question is, what do we eat? So I know, you know, you have a lot of thoughts, and I think actually when we met, you were vegan at the time. Are you still vegan?
I'm still vegan.
You're still vegan. And so talk to us about, you know, why vegan. Is vegan something that you believe is a good idea for some, a lot, all of your patients? Yeah. What's the science behind why vegan?
Right. So I don't love the term vegan. I almost don't even want to identify as vegan necessarily. Vegan's an ethic. Like, I never go into an exam room and talk ethics with my patients, and I don't talk to them about veganism. I'm vegan for reasons beyond health. Health is part of it, but for reasons beyond health. I'm vegan for the animals and the way we treat them, and the fact that I don't think that, you know, in this day and age that we need to eat animals. And so that's why I'm vegan. From a health standpoint, though, I do think a plant-predominant diet is the healthiest diet, and that's based on years and years and years of research and thousands of studies. There's a big difference between saying something's plant predominant and being vegan. So, for instance, they did a study called the Epic Oxford, which looked at vegans in Oxford, England, and they were looking at their health. Now, it turns out, actually, they were extremely healthy. They were as healthy or healthier than meat eaters, light meat eaters that ate vegetables. They had less heart disease, less cancers in general, but in some cancers where you would expect them to do well, they didn't do as well as you would expect. So when you compare them to other vegan cohorts like the Adventist Health, they weren't as healthy. But the problem was, when you looked at their diet, they only got about 23 to 25 grams of fiber. That is not a lot of fiber. And so you start asking yourself, what are these vegans eating? And it's not a whole food plant-based diet. It's certainly not a Sakara lunch, right?
Yeah, where you're getting 50 grams of fiber.
Right, where you're getting 50 grams. So they're not eating a lot of vegetables. And in fact, in the studies, they were eating as many vegetables as the meat eaters. They just weren't eating a very healthy diet at all. And so to take that group and say, this is an example of a vegan diet, well, maybe example of one type of vegan diet. There's been several of these studies now where they've come up with what's called a healthy plant index, where they look through their diet log and they say, okay, we're going to give you certain points for these kind of foods and take away points for these kind of foods. So if you're eating a healthy plant-based diet, you're exceedingly healthy. And in fact, the people with the highest healthy plant index have the most longevity, the least heart disease, the less cancer. But just being vegan doesn't get you there. You actually have to eat a vegetable-based diet. And by the way, there are people that don't eat a lot of meat and are actually very healthy because they're eating a lot of plants.
And where does the gut microbiome play a role in this?
Okay, so that's a much more complex and interesting field that is really relatively new, believe it or not. We're planning a research paper on that exact topic. And we're all fighting with each other because no one really knows so many answers. And like, we're trying to ask so many questions, it's hard to even begin the study.
Because when you're saying that fiber is so important, that's the first thing that comes to mind for me, is that it's changing your gut microbiome. Why is it important to you?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. It changes the gut microbiome. So, but what do we need it to change to? You know, what's good and what's bad? And here's the thing about gut microbiome. Because all these people are sending off their stool to like these labs to get evaluated and stuff like that. I could evaluate you in the morning and evaluate you in the evening, and you're going to have a different microbiome. It's constantly changing. And we used to think that there were specific bacteria that we wanted to, that are associated with weight loss. In fact, there's thumbprints now almost like there's a certain bacterial microbiome of an athlete. There's a certain bacterial microbiome of a vegan, et cetera. We're finding out a little bit more and more now that it may not be necessarily the specific bacteria, but the variety of bacteria, like how many different varieties of bacteria that you have. That's really the important aspect of it. And we do know that, so fiber is basically the food for the microbiome, and that the fiber foods tend to foster a more diverse microbiome. And we are showing that a more diverse microbiome is definitely being associated with a healthier life.
And what specifically, in terms of when you think about a predominantly plant-based diet versus a high-protein diet, like that's something that's really popular right now. You know, in this world of nutritionism, I think there are trends that come and go. You know, when Whitney and I started Sakara, no one knew what plant-based meant. And then it kind of got wrapped up with vegan, but really what it's supposed to mean is a diet based on whole foods, predominantly plants. And now I feel like people are kind of back to what was Atkins, but is now like the carnivore diet, predominantly meat. You know, it's just like it's so much about protein. And so one thing I talk about is helping people understand what protein is and what you need to make proteins, and what you need to make proteins are amino acids, and amino acids are in everything. And so what are your thoughts when it comes to plants, protein, and how that intersects with obesity, weight gain, weight loss?
Well, I wrote a whole book on this called Proteinaholic. The whole idea behind that book was I was seeing patients and they were so driven by protein that they were trying to eat protein at just about every meal. And if you're just looking at protein, eggs and bacon looks like a pretty good meal. Eggs and bacon, a steak, a cheeseburger, hold the bun, because it's got to be the bun that's making you sick, not the cheeseburger. And so that's what I was seeing people eat. And I was like, you know, why are you eating? Or I tell them to eat an apple, and I look at their snack and it's a Slim Jim. There is a lot of study on protein. When the RDA was developed initially, the recommended daily allowance, that was based on these basically nitrogen utilization studies where you measure all the nitrogen out, you measure the nitrogen in, and you see if you're getting more out than in. And what they found is that people needed a certain, it was a normal curve, right? So the normal person needed a certain amount, so 35, 40 grams, but there were some people that needed more. So they wanted to make sure that the RDA covered everybody. So even if you needed more, you'd be covered by this. So it wasn't the minimal amount. A lot of people talk about the RDA as the minimal amount of protein needed, and it really isn't. It was like the amount of protein to make sure that everybody gets enough protein. And so the RDA for men roughly is about 56 grams of protein a day, and for women it's about 46 grams of protein a day. Now, this really drives a lot of the online crowd crazy. They're way too heavily influenced by bodybuilding literature. The bodybuilding literature basically is looking to maximize muscle. And yeah, look, we all want to maximize muscle to a point, but there is no evidence that maximizing muscle means that you're going to live longer and be healthier. Certainly not having enough muscle is associated with a shorter life, sarcopenia. But does a bodybuilder live longer than a non-bodybuilder? No. In fact, they've got very short life expectancies. A study done out of Baylor showed that they only lived about 46 to 52 years old. Not very long, but trying to get the maximal muscle protein synthesis is a little bit crazy. We know from several studies now, basically 1.6 grams per kilogram is basically tops you off. So at 1.6 grams per kilogram, that's about as much protein in a day as your body's going to utilize to build muscle. Going higher doesn't get you more muscle. But when you start comparing 1.2 grams per kilogram to 1.6 grams per kilogram, it's not a huge amount of difference in muscle. Like I work out a lot. And for my age, I'm pretty strong. Could I be stronger if I ate more protein? Well, I average about 80 grams of protein a day. If I averaged 100, would I be stronger? I might be slightly stronger. I mean, we're talking like maybe I could lift 2 pounds more than I do. What benefit is that to me? Why do I need to struggle to eat more protein just to get those 2 pounds? It doesn't make any sense to me when I'm healthy at the amount of protein I'm getting. Now, if I was getting too little protein, that could be a serious problem because then I'd get sarcopenia. But obviously, I don't have sarcopenia. So this is the problem I've got to get with patients and the problem with online. There's no nuance. People are like, you know, it's the American way. If some is good, more is better. That doesn't always end to be the case. And what that happens is some very disordered eating. A lot of people eating multiple chicken breasts in order to get that protein, not caring about the saturated fat or the antibiotics and hormones in those chickens, or the data showing chickens are associated with lymphoma, leukemia, any of that kind of stuff just doesn't seem to factor in. They just got to get 1.6 grams per kilogram, or they're resorting to a lot of shakes. Everybody's like, we don't want processed food. You should never eat processed food. And then they make a protein shake, which is about as processed as you could possibly get with heavy metals and all that kind of stuff. And so it makes for disordered eating. I do think that it does make people tend to eat more calories in order to try to get more protein, and so that it gets them out of their calorie range and can be associated with multiple different health problems because of what's coming with that extra protein.
It's also like this idea of looking at muscle mass is such a narrow POV into overall human health. And it's one of the reasons, you know, we talk so much about gut health here at Sakara, because if you're going to try and understand human physiology and human health, you have to take a POV, like you have to use a lens. But it, to me, at least as I, you know, understand the literature and I'm researching, the gut has the most breadth and is the broadest lens that we can take. Like if we just look at heart health and try and eat just for our heart health or just for our brain health, like those are very narrow assumptions on what human health is. And I tell people, like, if you take apart a watch and then look down and try and tell the time, it's not going to tell you the time.
You miss the forest for the trees.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with nutrition. It's like, if you're going to try and eat just for muscle mass, or you're going to try and eat just for this one thing, you're not going to be able to tell your own time. You're not going to be able to tell your own health. And so I love gut health because it really is an epicenter with so many inputs and so many outputs. And study after study, it just shows how important getting enough plants, not necessarily only plants. And then the other thing that I think about is, and you mentioned it when you were just talking, Garth, but this idea of trade-offs, and you use the word nuance, but that people don't really like to have the trade-off conversation. So, okay, if you're going to try and optimize for muscle synthesis, then are you willing to have a conversation of what the trade-offs are on eating that much animal-based proteins? Because there are lots of studies that show that it has an impact, a negative impact on the gut. It increases TMAO and inflammation. And so it's like these narrow lenses into nutrition. It's one of the reasons why nutrition is so difficult, is because the minute you take like this narrow POV into it, you don't understand the whole.
It's so narrow that they're not even really looking at muscle mass or strength most of the time. They're looking at something called muscle protein synthesis. So they're not even looking at the whole picture, because in the end, you want to know how much muscle you get. And that's not just muscle protein synthesis. It's muscle protein synthesis and muscle protein breakdown. So they're so specific on something. And that's why you'll hear them say, well, animal protein is better than plant protein. There's a recent study looking at this, because animal protein is more leucine. Leucine stimulates muscle protein synthesis. And so they're saying, okay, well, you need more leucine, so you've got to have animal protein. But what does the science say? Well, there was a recent study out of Harvard looking at the Harvard Nurses Health Study and the Health Profession Study. And what they found is actually the more plant protein you ate, the less frail you were and the less chance of sarcopenia. So opposite of what these guys are saying, because that's taking a broader look. It's not saying, let's look at muscle protein synthesis. It's saying, let's look at overall health with the different protein that we get. What's the longevity and what's the frailty? So it's much deeper than that.
And what about all those people that talk about how much better they feel on a protein heavy diet of like when you're on these Instagram channels and you'll see a post and it's like comment and it'll say, you know, I never felt better. Do you think there's room for these types of very kind of dramatic, polarizing diets for short periods of time? Like, do you think that there are beneficial kind of therapeutic dietary interventions that are not good for long term, but maybe in short term? Like, why would someone feel so much better? I'm using air quotes here, so much better on something like a carnivore diet.
Because they're eating cheeseburgers and fries and milkshakes and total junk. And then they just go to just the cheeseburger.
To Whole Foods. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't even go to the cheeseburger. They do go to, you know, there is a movement to go towards, you know, grass fed or wild game or stuff like that. So they're eating a lot less processed sugar, a lot less junk food. A lot of them cut out dairy from their diet so they don't have the lactose intolerance type issues. I would be careful about anecdotes. Anecdotes, you know, there's a Instagram account called Carnivore Cringe. The person who owns the account goes onto all the different carnivore Facebook accounts and things like that and signs up as a carnivore. And they take pictures of all the complaints people have. And people are sick on this diet. I mean, really sick on it. The anecdotes that you hear from the one or two people online is not what you see in the support group rooms where everyone's complaining about all kinds of stuff. Diarrhea, constipation, vomiting, hair falling out, acne, all the stuff. So look, a couple of people are going to feel better because they were eating such a bad diet that they did improve their diet, but they're not going to be healthy. The other thing you got to look at when it comes to some of these diets, number one, we're looking for long-term health. I mean, I could get you to lose weight. I could put you on chemo. You're going to lose weight, but was it a good idea? We need to get you to lose weight and keep the weight off. That's what I'm worried about, is how do I keep the weight off? And dramatic, crazy diets that you can't stick to are not going to be successful long-term. And that goes for vegan too. I never tell my patients to go vegan per se. I talk to them about the importance of plants, but that you need to change your diet, but I don't tell them that you have to be radical about it. The other thing is, you remember that show, The Biggest Loser?
Yeah.
That was a terrible show. Yeah, I hated that show. But
It was tough.
It was a really negative view of obesity. They blamed the people a lot, made them stand on a scale without their shirt on, like as vulnerable as you could get. And it was all about this number on a scale. Well, that was actually a study. So Johns Hopkins ran a study on these people. And if you look at their resting metabolic rate going into the show, and then at the end of the show, their metabolism just took a deep dive with these extreme diets that they were on. They went back and looked at them 6 years later, and their metabolism never recovered. Even though they gained back weight, even though they continued exercising, their metabolism stayed low. So our metabolism is pretty interesting. There's all kinds of studies now about our body's ability to conserve energy. But these crash diets are really, really not good for you. And they can result in some serious damage to your metabolism long term. What we need to be concentrating on is long term life changes and not short term fixes with crazy diets.
Yeah, I think in part, people are just looking for the silver bullet, right? The thing that they're hoping is going to make them feel better, take away all their problems, get them to the body that they dream of, or help them live forever, and are hopeful in jumping into something that they think is a new diet with this trend towards a protein-heavy diet, which we've seen in the past. I mean, you wrote your book back in, I believe it was 2016. This protein obsession is nothing new. And yet, I think people are hoping that it's going to be new and that it's going to do something magical for them. But really, at the end of the day, it's the stuff that's not so sexy that really works. You know, eat real foods, mostly plants, not too much, like Michael Pollan says. And I think people are looking for that big dramatic, you know, they want to feel something. They want to feel like they're on the right path instead of this kind of slow and steady wins the race, which then in turn doesn't have that huge impact on your metabolism by throwing your body into shock, but gradually leads your body in that direction of feeling safe and supported and getting the nutrients that it needs and supports a healthy gut microbiome. But it's more difficult for people to have patience for that slow process.
And not only that, they get very influenced. I mean, the social media nonsense is a real problem. I mean, you got people saying things that are just outrageous with no backing whatsoever. And they say it so vehemently. And people love a guru. And then these guys become their guru. I was in a debate recently with Sean Baker, who's like the original carnivore guy. Sean is just on there all the time, just screaming about meat, eating his steak, making fun of vegans, et cetera, et cetera. And so he gets on with me, and there was none of that. He didn't bring up, he was like calm and like, you know, didn't really have any research because there's no research for the carnivore diet. You know that, right? No research, none, zero, zilch. So I'm just throwing papers at him and all that stuff. And at one point, the moderator who herself is carnivore diet said something. She was like, but Sean, but this is what you said on your Instagram. He's like, well, my Instagram is really not me. That's just a character that I play.
Hi.
But that's a problem, right? Because that character has a huge amount of influence on these people. The alpha males want to be all tough and they think that, you know, oh, look at Sean eating this and therefore that makes me tough. And they like this guru and they follow this kind of guru type almost religion that this carnivore diet has become. He said in the debate, he was like, look, I don't know what's going to happen to people on a carnivore diet. In person, when I tell someone, to eat a carnivore diet, I say, well, you could add some fruit or some vegetables. I was like, but that's not what you say online. And that's the problem, is that the online is what's driving people to eat this way.
Yeah, I just did a post about this because it really breaks my heart, because it's like we're not taking people's health seriously. And you know, what happens on social media is you have to make content that engages, and that tends to be very polarizing content. And so then that's the content that gets circulated, but it's polarizing, it's not truth. And so because people see it and see it everywhere, because it is being interacted with, then they think it is the truth. And you know, like Whitney said, it might not be polarizing to sit here and talk about eating a whole food plant rich diet. It's actually, I think, bores most people, and they want to like take a nap when we start talking about it. But it's the truth. And sometimes the truth isn't on one end of the spectrum. And I mean, oftentimes it's right in the middle, and you got to do your best and eat well and eat whole foods. And it can actually be much more simple than I think we're making it out to be.
Yeah, and funny enough, they like to make it seem complex. There's that guy, Paul, who's like, not only are plants not good for you, they will kill you. And it's based on like the breakdown, like one product in the plant called lectins. Not for a second does he stop and say, well, are beans bad? Like on big population studies, are beans bad for you? In fact, a meta-analysis showed that the number one food associated with longevity is beans. How could beans be poisonous and yet associated with the longest life? But this doesn't go into his mind. It doesn't fit his narrative. So instead, he looks at one little part of a bean called lectin and tell you that it's going to kill you. And then other crazy things like, I mean, some of the stuff just is so puzzling to me.
It's also the complexities of Mother Nature that we're trying to understand and again isolate. And I have this theory, like, no food is only good for you. Like, you can find something in beans that probably causes inflammation if that's all you ever eat for your whole life. You can find something in kale if that's all you ever eat. And so that's back to your original point, Garth, of like diversity. It's like our genetics and our biology are that way so that we go out and find diversity and don't just sit in one place and eat the same thing over and over and over again. Like, there's a reason.
Yeah, there was a good study called the PURE study. This was a study the carnivores were latching onto to come after me and say, oh no, look, you need protein. And it found that the more protein you ate, even animal protein, the more animal protein you eat specifically, you live longer. And so, oh, look, you're wrong, because no one's really reading the study, right? They see the headline. But if you look at the study more carefully, they were looking at each country and how much protein it produces. They weren't even looking at intake. What they found is that the countries eating the lowest protein and the least animal protein were the poorest countries, and all they were eating were rice. And that was basically 90% of their diet was rice. So these aren't countries that are healthy at all. They don't have sanitation. They don't have healthcare. So of course, protein now becomes a proxy for wealth and, you know, vaccination and health and all these kind of stuff. And so obviously they're not going to be as healthy, but it's not the protein that's making them healthy. It's the protein is a correlation in this situation. Another confusing factor you find online. It's a confusing world, and I understand, but let's use common sense. Fruits, vegetables, and beans are loaded with nutrients and grains. The healthiest populations in the world are eating tons of fruits, vegetables, and beans. Population studies where they follow groups. Do you know much about the Adventist Health Study? You can't do a better study than this. So the Seventh-day Adventists, they live in Loma Linda, California. They agreed to be studied. It's interesting because their one zip code is the healthiest group of people in the entire world. And they're surrounded by unhealthy people. Just minutes away, there's a different longevity. And so this was fascinating to researchers. The Adventists agreed to be studied. And the interesting thing is it's a heterogeneous population, right? So you can't blame it on genes. They all have different genes. It's different nationalities and all kinds of stuff in the church. The other thing about it is the same with like the environment, right? If there's toxicity in the water or the air, they're all exposed to it. They all don't drink and don't smoke for the most part. And they all don't eat a lot of meat, but some eat meat. Some are lacto-vegetarian, some are pescatarian, and some are vegan. And in fact, they've got the largest vegan population in the world. Can you get a better population to study prospectively? This is the best cohort population, been studied for many years. And you can see that with each increasing increment of animal protein, you get more diabetes, more heart disease, more of certain cancers, and shorter life expectancy. Except for pesco-vegetarian had a similar life expectancy to vegans. But in general, vegans were the healthiest population of that Seventh-day Adventist group. And you just really can't get a better study than that. And so if you ask the carnivores about that study, they say, oh, the Loma Linda population has millions of dollars invested in this. Like there's a big vegetable lobby trying to make a bunch of money.
I wish that vegetable lobby. Yeah.
I'm waiting to get paid by Big Kale.
Yeah, same.
I feel like the gut microbiome is something we talk about in every episode of the Sakara Life podcast. And I think people just still don't understand just how profound the gut microbiome is and how important it is to your overall health. It affects every system in your body, from your hormone health to your brain chemicals, your digestion, your metabolism, your sex drive. It really is the epicenter of our health. And yet people
are getting like half of the fiber, daily fiber they should be getting. I mean, when we set out to create Sakara, we anchored it on gut health because we both had such gut dysbiosis and imbalanced microbes. And we know the number one indicator of a healthy gut is having a diversity of microbes, but nobody really knows what that means or how to get it. Or I think it's really confusing to people. It's like, okay, I have all this bacteria in my gut, and what? I need to take care of them? It's hard to imagine how microbes in your gut can impact your cardiometabolic health or your mental health or your hormonal health or your fertility, all these things. But every time, like it's so entrenched in the literature at this point that every time you look at any disease, you can start to correlate changes in the microbiome. So if we can start with the gut and kind of like work backwards, that's still an amazing approach to overall health.
Probiotics are really important. We've been talking about probiotics for a long time, but I think more and more people are starting to talk about prebiotics. And it's something you and I talk about a lot, about fibers, plural. There's not just one type of fiber. There's multiple types of fibers. And they go in and they feed those microbes within our gut. That's what our microbes like to eat. If you want to be building up a healthy ecosystem of good microbes in your gut, they like to eat prebiotic fibers. They like to eat polyphenols, resistant starches. That's what they like to live on, and that's how they're going to proliferate in your gut.
Well, we are so excited to talk about our Sakara
fiber super powder, you guys, because it took us 3 years to make. And we really made it because if you think about what is one of the most important things you can get into your diet every single day, it really is fiber. I mean, 95% of Americans are not getting enough fiber every single day. We're in this fiber epidemic. And so we really wanted to create a fiber that would really help you hit that 35 to 50 grams of fiber, which, by the way, you guys, most people are getting under 15. You know, they say you should get 25, but when you study functional medicine, they say you should get 35 to 50 grams. And if you eat Saqqara breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you're getting 35 to 50 grams every day. And so in creating this product, we thought, how can we help people reach that number who can't eat our meals? If that's the number one determining factor of a healthy gut, how can we help people really build those healthy guts? So you get 6 grams of fiber from 10 sources of fruits and vegetable. We have prebiotic fiber in there as well as digestive enzymes. So it's not just fiber like your grandmother's fiber. It's fiber from 10 different sources plus these digestive enzymes and prebiotics that really help you stay regular, decrease bloat, help with satiety.
Ooh, we're making fiber sexy again.
It's about time.
You can find more details and enjoy 20% off your first order with code POD. That's code POD at checkout for 20% off your first order. Order now. How much of this do you believe is aesthetic? But how much of this really is about longevity versus how much of this is about aesthetics, wanting to look fit, have bigger muscles into your later years?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of it. But the question is, can you not get that out of a plant-based diet? And obviously you can. If you look online, there's lots of, you know, very fit plant-based people. It's worse than when I was younger, this kind of obsession with what our bodies look like and muscle. And I do agree with you, Whitney. I think a lot of it has to do with muscle. And that's where they're getting the sale on the protein, is saying that animal protein is better for muscle growth than plant protein, which has been shown not to be true. And that you need these really high amounts of animal protein. And a lot of the studies are funded by meat. Obviously, this is how meat's going to get sold. This is how they're going to get over this bad image that they had for a while. And I don't really think people care about how long they live. When you're a kid in your 20s, that certainly isn't really a big issue to you. It is an issue when you get to my age. You start thinking, hey, how many more years do I have here? But I think for most of the population that's on Instagram and social media, they're concerned with how they look, and they think that an animal protein diet is going to get them muscles faster and quicker than a plant protein diet. And that's simply not true. I will say this. A lot of the plant-based people are into the plant-based protein. So now they're like, yeah, we agree you need a lot of protein. I see it every day. This is how I eat 150 grams of protein a day. This pushing 150 grams of protein means people are going to try to switch to a plant-based diet, and they're going to try to get 150 grams of protein. That's hard to do unless you're doing supplements or eating a ton of beans. But if you go to a vegan diet and all of a sudden you're eating, you're going from 10 grams of fiber a day to 60 grams of fiber a day in order to get 150 grams of protein, you're going to bloat. But I could eat that much and not bloat, but I've been eating that way for years. But if the average person does that, they're going to go on and be like, oh my God, the plant-based diet, I felt terrible. Because they haven't given their body time to adjust to it, and they're trying to get this ridiculously high amount of protein on it. And that's where I really have a problem with the super high protein diet when it comes to plant proteins, is I think it drives people away. Everybody starts inflating and bloating.
Is there a risk in eating too much protein?
I think there is. Well, look, on the animal side, definitely, because there's a risk of all the other things that come with it, right? So there's saturated fat that comes with it. There's the effect on the microbiome and the production of TMAO, as Danielle mentioned earlier. When you cook a steak, you get something called advanced glycated end products. So when you're basically cooking the glucose molecules stored in the muscle, the caramelizing process, those grill marks you get what's called advanced glycated end products, which oxidizes. So you get something called heterocyclic amines. These are toxic chemicals that are definitely carcinogenic. None of this stuff is in plants. You don't get any of this stuff in plant-based protein. So you're getting that with the animal proteins. Plus, You've got a lot of leucine and methionine, which is activating the mTOR. And IGF-1, whether you believe that actually has an effect on longevity or not. With the plant proteins, you don't get any of that. There's no saturated fat. There's no. The only problem, I think, with the plant proteins is if you're really going to try to push it, plant food is less protein dense. So you got to eat more of it to get that amount of protein. And if you're trying to push it to 150 grams, you're going to be eating a lot of legumes and doing a lot of shakes. And you're not going to feel good doing that.
And that's back to Whitney's point about aesthetics. It's like what actually might be the healthiest way to eat might not bring you to having as big of muscles as you'd like.
But you will. Like, seriously, this is the problem. Is you think you need 150 to have a good-looking body, and you don't. You need 60 to 70. 60 to 70, you're going to get plenty of muscle growth. For 15 years, I've been eating about 70 to 80 grams of protein a day.
Do you count your protein, or do you think about it, or is it just like you eat a lot of variety of plants and don't worry about it?
I eat a lot of variety of plants and I don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I don't ever count. I mean, I've counted for the academic purpose of understanding what I'm doing, but I do check my muscle mass, which has only gone up over the past 15 years, and I check my VO2 max and all those kind of things just for seeing how this diet is working on me personally. But when you look at the research, I mean, first of all, the other thing I see is people that don't exercise trying to get high protein. Getting high protein, if you don't lift weights, is kind of a waste, or if you don't exercise, it's just total waste. But the difference is, once you get over about 1 gram per kilogram, the differences in actual muscle growth, not muscle protein synthesis, that to me is just, that's a mechanistic study. That's like looking at lectins outside of the bigger picture. For me to look at a study and think it has worth, I want to know that they actually measured the muscle and it got bigger, whether that's by CAT scan or tape measure or DEXA scan. But I want to know that the muscle actually got bigger and they actually were able to lift more. And looking for studies that have that as an endpoint that show a benefit with higher protein, there's very few, and the ones that do show it, it's such a slim victory for them that I'm like, you know what? I don't need that extra, you know, 0.5% muscle mass.
And all it comes with.
Yeah, and all it comes with it, yeah. I mean, yeah, if I was a bodybuilder, if I was on a stage getting paid for it, it would make a
difference.
Right, if
it was your job.
I grew up with a guy who is a professional bodybuilder, and he used to post pictures on his Facebook of what he was eating, and it was a massive amount of carbs. He would post a picture of a gigantic bowl of oatmeal with gummy bears in it and Reese's Pieces and fake maple syrup all over it and just be, you know, carbo-loading. And that was in order to be able to grow muscle as well. You know, that it's, I think a lot of people, they forget that carbs help you grow muscle, not protein.
Yeah, you have to have, that's actually changing in the bodybuilding world. So in the bodybuilding world, they're definitely not carnivores, right? They're not on the carnivore diet. They're eating a lot of carbs, a lot of meat and a lot of carbs, but they're eating a lot of food, because what really you need in order to grow muscle is calories. But you do need carbs and you need glycogen to be restored. And so they're all getting into that. But what I think what's missing in this world is, like, we've come to demonize carbs. Like, people are petrified of carbs. I had a patient, I talked about this in my book. I had a very smart lady. She's a NASA scientist from down the street. She came to see me for weight loss. And I'm looking at her diet log. And I always ask patients, what do you think it is that's causing you to gain weight? And she says, it's carbs. And I'm looking at her diet and it's eggs and bacon and chicken and fish. I'm like, but there's no carbs on this. She said, well, I'm from Ghana originally. And twice a week, I get together with my friends and we eat a typical Ghana diet. So I said to her, knowing that Ghana has the lowest obesity rate in the entire world, I said to her, well, have you ever been to Ghana? And she's like, yes. I was like, did you see any obese people there? She's like, no. She was like, I was the biggest person there. And she goes, you know, I was there for 2 months and I actually lost weight. Of course, because it's not the carbs that are making you fat. And in fact, people don't know this. Carbs really can't make you fat. Carbs in and of themselves, our bodies have a very hard time turning carbs to fat. It's called de novo lipogenesis. And they've done all these overfeeding studies where they fed people tons of carbs. It takes a lot of carbs to turn a carb into fat. But people don't know that. They just think if they eat carbs, it somehow magically becomes fat. If you eat fat, it becomes fat immediately. It's absorbed as fat, it's stored as fat. Boom, fat. But that's not true with carbs.
How do you talk to patients if you're dealing with people who want to lose weight often? What is your main message? I heard you talk about fiber. I heard you talk about getting enough plants. What is your main message to them?
Yeah, so my main message is a few things. First of all, don't blame yourself. All right, it's a tough problem. It's multifactorial. You are not a failure, but realize that you got to make a change, because if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you always got. So we've got to talk about realistic changes that you can make. And you've got to be honest about where you are and what you're doing. You can't make excuses, because I hear excuses all the time. You also have to understand that people, and I tell the patient, you have put yourself in a box and you say, this is who I am. I don't like this. I don't do this. This is who I am. And you could be so much more than that. You just don't know that yet. And I could see you or the patient on the other side of this, which thankfully I get to see in my job all the time, where you become a completely different person. And you could get there and I'm going to help you, but it does take an effort. And that effort means that you need to look at your lifestyle from many different factors. You need to look at the obvious. What are you eating? When are you eating? We didn't talk about that. How much are you eating? Why are you eating? And we need to get to the bottom of those different factors. We need to look at what diets have worked around the world. What does the National Weight Control Registry? I tell them stories because people like to hear stories. What do people that have lost the most weight and kept it off, what are they eating? What are people in Okinawa eating? What are people in the Coin Peninsula, Costa Rica eating? What did your ancestors eat? So we go through that story. Then we go through the message that it also has to do with activity. The other problem that I see is that there are under-muscled people. We didn't get to this. We're talking about the upper limits of protein, but there is a lower limit, and you can get too low, and you can not exercise and lose muscle. And I got people so desperate to get a number on the scale to change that they sacrifice their muscle and then lower their metabolism. So we have to set realistic ideas of what we're going for, which is not necessarily weight loss on a scale, but fat loss. And then we got to look at other factors. What meds are you taking that might be hindering you? What's your stress? And how can you handle stress? What's your sleep habits? So it really has to be a multifactorial program in order to be able to change your lifestyle. And then sometimes that requires some help with medicines and surgery.
Well, thank you so much for all your knowledge and the work that you do. We're grateful. We'd like to end with something called light work, which is basically just, you know, some homework for our listeners to do that helps them, you know, shine their brightest lights. It could be something we talked about today. It could be something that you personally do. It could be something you talk to your patients about, but some sort of practice, ritual, anything that comes to mind.
Oh, gosh. Man, there's so many. If you don't know actual data on yourself, it's hard to make changes. So I do start out with saying, I don't know that I like people calorie counting necessarily for the long term, because that creates a lot of anxiety and it's tough. But you should journal. Why am I eating? Why do I want this food? Start asking yourself, be introspective. What are my goals? That's really important, because we tend to lose track of our goals over time. But you should have long-term goals and short-term goals, and this should all be journaled on a daily basis. How have my actions today led towards my goals in the future? Because being introspective and understanding and being honest with yourself about all these different factors is going to be the key to making real lifestyle changes in the future.
Yeah, I love that. And I also feel like it's honoring that who you are now is not just because of what you're eating. It's who you surround yourself with, childhood, what you think, your habits, it's from so many different inputs. And so I love the idea of looking to understand all of those inputs to understand what's gotten you here in the first place, or at least try to understand.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
No problem, guys. Thanks for having me.